The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all of these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise also has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Colin Powell, from fighting in Vietnam to his role in the Iraq War. We look back at Powell's legacy in American foreign affairs and what the Powell Doctrine was all about.
We must use decisive, or what's often said, overwhelming force, and there must be a plan to exit.
Also today, more problems in Haiti. North American missionaries are kidnapped, and a transportation strike brings life to a standstill.
You know, right now, you see, it's very empty. Everything is gone.
So this is not normal?
No, it's not normal.
And the full range of TikTok content is not just lip-syncing and dance moves. You can also learn indigenous languages from across the globe.
If people continue to put material out on TikTok, it's like a library.
TikTok lessons for endangered languages. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to have you with us on this Monday. We begin today in Haiti, following this weekend's news about 17 missionaries who were kidnapped there, 16 Americans and one Canadian, among them five children. The FBI is investigating, but Haitian officials are not speaking. What we do know is that kidnapping has been a persistent threat in Haiti and getting worse, one terrible symptom of a political and economic breakdown there. The World's Monica Campbell is on assignment in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. Monica, what do we know so far about this abduction of 17 foreigners?
The group, a Christian humanitarian aid group, was in town just east of here, of Port-au-Prince. And every Haitian journalist I'm talking to, analysts, everybody is searching for more information. There are a lot of rumors, but Haitian officials are not speaking about this kidnapping. The U.S. government isn't speaking about it. We know the FBI is here in the capital now, but it's a black box of information so far.
So not much from officials. What are you hearing from Haitians about this news?
Yeah, I mean, Haitians here are aware that religious groups are being targeted more by gangs. People also know that these Christian missionaries were traveling in an area controlled by a very notorious gang here in Haiti. But one thing that really struck me was that they knew about this story about the missionaries, which is getting a lot of international press. But they also know that this is everyday life in Haiti. And I spoke to one man about this. His name is Jean Guito. I spoke to him where he grew up in a very working class area of Port-au-Prince. And he spoke to me in Spanish because he's been recently deported to Haiti after living for years in South America. And here's what he said.
Si tú estás en tu casa, tú quieres salir para comprar algo, dice, no, tú no puedes salir. Es mi país, pero nadie puede vivir en Haití.
And what he's saying is that I live in a country where I have to think two times before leaving to buy food outside of my home, money in my pocket. I'm at risk of being kidnapped. People who are kidnapped who are poor. That is what is happening here. You're seeing mass kidnappings of different levels of society. Buses being hijacked right now is a big deal, like entire buses being taken over, people stripped of their belongings and then just left.
Yeah, you're talking about buses there, Monica. There is a general transportation strike in Haiti today. What's that about?
They're protesting because they have to negotiate with gangs as they move through the city. Being a bus driver in Haiti is a very high-risk occupation. So this morning, I took a very early morning drive out with a very well-known traffic reporter here in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince. His name is Mackinson Remy. And I wanted to see kind of through his eyes how the city was waking up. And there were burning tires on the main roads. Part of this general strike is to put tires blockading ways for people to get around town. It was eerily quiet. There were some people on bicycles trying to get to work, but none of the usual bustle of buses and motorbikes shuttling people around. And here's what Mackinson said to me.
You know, right now, you see, it's very empty. Everything is gone.
So this is not normal?
No, it's not normal. Before, you will see much car, much motorcycle, because the protest against the government, against the life in Haiti.
So back to the news of the mass abductions. I mean, the role of gangs in these rampant kidnappings is significant. And though we're talking today about American and Canadian missionaries in Haiti, Haitian people have long confronted the power of these gangs. I mean, as you said earlier, it's an everyday problem. What is the actual power of these gangs, Monica?
Well, this weekend was a perfect example of that. While the news came in of these missionaries abducted by this gang, supposedly they're the main suspect, we also had a commemoration here in Haiti honoring one of Haiti's founding fathers. And so the prime minister of the country had planned to lay a wreath to mark the occasion in an area run by gangs in Port-au-Prince. Mm-hmm. So when he goes to try and do that, there was gunfire to keep him out of the area. He had to seek shelter. And then later the same day, one of Haiti's most powerful gang leaders went and placed his own wreath. And he's wearing a white suit and he looked very presidential. And everybody here was just so struck by this show of power, a moment illustrating the government's weakness and the power of the gangs.
And when we say gangs, we're not talking kind of street gangs with knives. I mean, the armed power is much greater in some of these more notorious gangs, right?
Yes, they control swaths of the city. I mean, we had an earthquake recently here, you know, outside of Port-au-Prince. The gangs were blocking the main roads that were bringing humanitarian aid, you know, trucks trying to bring humanitarian aid to the earthquake-struck zone, you know, control that type of route. These gangs are definitely well-armed and often with U.S. weapons.
The World's Monica Campbell in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. In the coming days, she'll be reporting on how some of the conditions we've just been talking about are pushing many Haitians to flee the country, often via dangerous and illegal routes. Monica, thank you very much. Stay safe.
Thanks, Marco.
Tomorrow on the program, why Christian groups on missions overseas are often seen by locals as symbols of wealth and power. Political and military leaders from around the world are paying tribute today to Colin Powell. The former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State died today at the age of 84. Powell had been battling multiple myeloma, a type of blood cancer that made him more susceptible to complications from COVID-19. Powell served both Democratic and Republican presidents and became one of the most popular public figures in the U.S. Born in Harlem in New York City, the son of Jamaican immigrants, by Powell's own admission, his biggest failure were the faulty claims he made before the UN to justify the Iraq War. Here he is in 2010 on CNN talking about the role President George W. Bush asked him to play before the invasion of Iraq.
I turned the dial, there's no question about it. And that's what the president wanted me to do and what I was supposed to do.
You regret it.
I regret it now because the information was wrong. Of course I do. But I will always be seen as the one who made the case before the international community.
Jeffrey Matthews has looked carefully at Powell's role on the world stage. He's the author of Colin Powell, Imperfect Patriot. Jeffrey Matthews, we obviously want to get to that moment at the UN. But let's start with the very beginnings of Colin Powell's military career. He served two tours of duty in Vietnam in his 20s and early 30s. How did that help shape his worldview?
Well, certainly, I think it hardened his commitment to the country and to the army in particular. And over time, as was common for people who stayed in the military after Vietnam, was this idea that would eventually evolve into what was known as the Powell Doctrine. And so there's a direct line between his Vietnam experience and this idea that if the country is going to go to war, that it must have a clear vision, that it must have the support of the American people, and that we must use decisive, or what's often said, overwhelming force, and there must be a plan to exit the war. And so I think even though he was relatively young at the time, there is that direct connection from when he becomes a four-star general and can really implement that vision.
So let's talk about the My Lai massacre. That was in 1968, the mass murder of unarmed South Vietnamese civilians. Colin Powell was not in Vietnam at the time of that massacre, but he did investigate early reports of it. Those came back to haunt him. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, so this comes during Powell's second tour in Vietnam. The first time he went, he was one of JFK's early advisors. But about 90 days after the My Lai massacre had happened, Powell was coincidentally assigned to that very unit as a staff officer. And in that position, there were reports going around that a massacre had happened. And he was one of the officers in this AmeriCal division, as it was known, asked to investigate. And there really was not much of an investigation. And Powell essentially mimicked some senior officers and their reporting and saying that there was no evidence of one and that, in fact, relations between the U.S. forces and South Vietnamese civilians was actually an excellent one. And so I think it was dealt with pretty quickly. And in hindsight, we can see that Powell, even as a junior officer, he was part of indirectly the Army's cover-up of the My Lai massacre, which, of course, doesn't get exposed until several years later.
So let's focus now on Powell's years as Secretary of State that began in 2001. In the weeks after 9/11, many in the White House, President George W. Bush's White House, many were pushing for a rapid bombing campaign in Iraq. Powell did not join them. Why not?
In the week after 9/11, it was Powell who was kind of the bulwark against a rush to war against Iraq. I mean, immediately after 9/11, people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, they were advising the president to launch an attack against Iraq. And Powell, from the very beginning, was insisting that this made no sense because there was no evidence that Iraq had anything to do with 9/11. President Bush accepted Powell's advice, and I think Powell deserves a lot of credit for the influence that he had in those first days.
That push for war in Iraq happening while plans were afoot, we should recognize, to invade Afghanistan, where al-Qaeda was getting cover from the Taliban. Then in February of 2003, Powell appeared before the UN advocating for war in Iraq. Here he is.
The gravity of this moment is matched by the gravity of the threat that Iraq's weapons of mass destruction pose to the world.
So during this presentation, Secretary Powell is holding a vial, a test tube with material that represents what a sample of anthrax might look like. It wasn't anthrax. It was really dramatic, though. He went on to say this about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
This is evidence, not conjecture. This is true. This is all well documented.
Well, Jeffrey Matthews, as we know, was not well documented. Saddam Hussein did not possess weapons of mass destruction. And Colin Powell called this moment the biggest blot on his record. Did Secretary Powell, in fact, know there were no weapons of mass destruction? What do the documents tell us?
Indeed, it was a huge mistake, as he made. But I really think what it's an example of, Marco, is what psychologists call confirmation bias. Powell believed 100% that there were weapons of mass destruction. And so when he went to the CIA with his staff for 3.5 days to essentially rewrite a speech from scratch, they relied on the national intelligence estimate from the CIA, not a political document. And what they chose to do essentially was emphasize any piece of evidence that they thought confirmed weapons of mass destruction, and they dismissed or ignored a lot of evidence or question that suggested, well, we really don't know what they have. And so I think when Powell went to give that speech, one of the reasons he was so convincing is because, for the most part, he believed it himself.
So Powell's own people at the State Department Intelligence Bureau had called many of the claims about weapons of mass destruction weak, not credible, highly questionable. Was Powell cherry-picking intelligence to fit his own bias, or was he so deep in that narrative that he didn't think twice?
When his State Department analysts came out and saw a draft of the report, I think they identified something like 32 things they disagreed with, and Powell in the end changed about 28 of those. And one of the big issues was these kind of aluminum tubes where the State Department said they were used for conventional weapons, not nuclear weapons. And Powell overrode the department, and he really shouldn't have, because if you read the intelligence itself, and you can read this online now, you can see clearly there were doubts, including from the Department of Energy, that this had anything to do with the nuclear program. And so I think Powell, in the end, you know, he told me in my interview with him that he was afraid that his obituary, it would lead with the speech. As a matter of fact, he tried to talk me out of leading my book with the story of the speech. But it was emblematic in many ways of Powell's career, because a big theme of Powell's life is intense loyalty. And the UN speech, like so many other big decisions, good and bad, that he made out of intense loyalty to his superiors.
And here we are talking about that speech today. I mean, is that how Colin Powell will be remembered?
It certainly shouldn't be. I mean, in the post-Cold War era, I don't think there's a single military person who became as popular and influential as Powell did. And we have to take both his military career and his civilian career and assess them independently and emphasize both the good and the bad.
Jeffrey Matthews is the author of Colin Powell, Imperfect Patriot. The former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State died today at the age of 84. Jeffrey, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. U.S. intelligence officials were reportedly taken by surprise when they learned back in August that China tested a hypersonic missile. According to the Financial Times, the nuclear-capable missile circled the globe, traveling five times the speed of sound, before zeroing in on its target. Today, China's foreign ministry denied that this was a hypersonic missile test. A spokesman said it was a spacecraft and it happened in July. The World's Patrick Wynn is following the story and is on the line with me now. What are the details about this test, Patrick, that got people's attention in Washington?
There's some confusion around this because it really was just in the last few hours that China's government said, hey, this was just a spacecraft test, though they didn't elaborate on what that meant very much. That said, it is a fact that China is working on hypersonic missiles, so this could be completely true. Hypersonic missiles are just an amazing piece of military hardware. So if you think about the traditional ICBM, the intercontinental ballistic missiles, you can think about, you know, throwing a softball underhand at someone way out in left field, and it goes up in a big arc and down, and you can see it coming. That's how ballistic missiles travel. The hypersonic missile, Marco, is like, you know, if you fired that baseball from a cannon and as it's moving, you can manipulate it and make it veer suddenly from left to right. So the person in this analogy out in the outfield cannot catch it because the angle of approach can suddenly shift and it's too fast to catch anyway. So that's what we're talking about. That's what a hypersonic missile is. And again, China says this wasn't a hypersonic missile test, and that may be true, but they have not yet explained why it looked so much like one.
You did say that China is developing hypersonic missiles. So if they have one eventually, what would that mean for the U.S.? A real game changer?
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, it is true that if China does get a working hypersonic missile, there is zero chance the U.S. military can shoot it down. It would just be way too fast. The military would barely see it coming. But the deal is, you know, China already has 100 ICBMs, 100 ballistic missiles that can carry nuclear warheads. And the U.S. is already not very good at intercepting them either. I mean, hypothetically, right now, they could fire a dozen at U.S. cities and most would hit their target. And anyone who lived through the Cold War understands that that is very unlikely because of mutually assured destruction. You know, the U.S. has 5,000 nukes that it could fire right back, and then we're all incinerated. But I think what may be freaking out U.S. officials here is, you know, people assume the U.S. military is way ahead of China in every arena. But in this one, the Pentagon does not have a ready-to-deploy hypersonic missile of its own. U.S. is just like China. It's still in a testing phase. Actually, here's what one of those tests sounds like. So that is what 6,500 miles per hour sounds like. That's from a video filmed at a U.S. military base 2 years ago. But I should add the U.S. did another hypersonic missile test last month. So both countries are in the testing phase.
Patrick, do we know why Washington was apparently taken by surprise by this news?
Well, according to the Financial Times, they looked to five different intelligence sources, all of whom said, we didn't know they had this technology. We are taken by surprise. Because China has just now denied it, there hasn't been enough time for both sides to go back and forth. The Secretary of Defense was asked about this today, and he said, well, we're always keeping our eye on what China's doing. So we don't know how much they knew. Hey, maybe China's telling the truth. Maybe it wasn't a hypersonic missile test in the first place. Either way, they are working on this, so that's just a fact.
So regardless of what exactly China was testing here, a hypersonic missile or they say a spacecraft, what do you think this episode says about the current military tensions between the U.S. and China?
Well, actually, China's propaganda outlets, without saying, yes, this is a real hypersonic test, they were bragging today, saying, well, you know, if we did do this, we did it actually 2 months ago, and the U.S. didn't even notice, hypothetically. And look how easily we could catch you by surprise. So that kind of goes against what the foreign ministry is saying. I think the bottom line is, The U.S. has a lot of fear in this area. The U.S. is neck and neck with China on hypersonic missiles. It's not way ahead. You know, the Pentagon likes to be way ahead of China on everything. So every year it's spending billions and billions of dollars on developing hypersonic missiles. And I haven't even mentioned that Russia is testing hypersonic missiles as well and is quite far along its way. So whether this test was real or if the report is wrong, we are seeing the anxiety that it stirs up by this new type of arms race, which will generate a lot of money for defense contractors and cost taxpayers a lot of money.
The World's Patrick Nguyen, one of our correspondents in Asia. Thank you very much, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
It is hard to miss a walrus. They're loud and huge, sometimes more than 3,000 pounds. But when you're looking for them across the vast Arctic landscape where they live, it is trickier. The World's Anna Kussmer has this report about a team of scientists in the UK that's asking the public for help.
From 400 miles above ground, walruses look teeny tiny.
So walrus from space, we look like grains of rice.
That's Hannah Kuben of the British Antarctic Survey. She specializes in studying wildlife from space. That's wildlife seen from space. It's an increasingly popular way for scientists to see how animal populations are doing across a large area.
We have this incredible tool that's up in space that we could adapt for conserving wildlife.
They're asking the public to help them look through hundreds of thousands of images and count walruses hanging out on beaches and rocky coasts.
We thought, let's use the power of the village and ask the public if they want to help out.
The project is called Walrus from Space. Rod Downey is with the Worldwide Fund for Nature, which is partnering on the project.
Walrus are big, powerful animals, but they're also incredibly vulnerable to the climate crisis because the ice is literally melting out beneath them.
And they need the ice to rest and have babies. Downey says with the data, researchers can advise policymakers on how to help walruses survive a changing world.
We know that walrus can be easily disturbed by shipping traffic, by aircraft and other forms of industrial development. You know, and this is particularly poignant now as the Arctic becomes more accessible to these sorts of activities as sea ice is in rapid decline.
And Downey says, if the project can get lots of volunteers to spend some time considering walruses, that's another perk.
Engaging over 500,000 people in walrus science, we think, is a real benefit from this approach. In the face of the climate crisis that we're facing at the moment, you know, it's easy for people, for individuals, to feel really quite powerless.
So from behind your computer screen, you can help. It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. Oh, no, wait. That one wasn't a walrus. It was a rock. False alarm. For the World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
What happens to all the inexpensive clothes that never get worn? Our report from Ghana coming up on the show. You're listening to The World. Increasingly, the Dead Sea in Israel is threatened by pollution and climate change, and it's shrinking. A museum, a photographer, and 200 nude models came together to draw attention to that.
It was a very, very, very spiritual and I'd say just breathtaking installation.
Trying to give life to the Dead Sea. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's never been cheaper to be in vogue. The downside, though, a lot of our so-called fast fashion barely gets worn. It's estimated that each year $500 million worth of clothes is hardly worn. Often it's never worn. Millions of these garments with Western labels end up in places like Ghana in West Africa. The flood of clothes is now overwhelming Ghana's infrastructure and creating environmental problems. Reporter Ridwan Karim, Dini Osman has our story from Ghana's capital, Accra.
Kantamanto, situated in the central business district of Accra, is a veritable city within a city, arguably one of the largest second-hand clothing markets in the world. Over 30,000 people in closely packed wooden stalls, bursting at their seams with large bales of second-hand fashion. From underwear to shirts, trousers, shoes, and the list goes on. Traders call these used clothes asobroniwewu, meaning dead white man's clothes. One trader, Edith Ephraim, explains.
We believe no one will give out their clothes if they are alive. These clothes we sell belong to the dead white man.
Competition for customers is quite fierce. Traders here adopt all manner of antics to attract buyers. They sing and even dance. Ephraim has been in the trade for 17 years.
The business is really good. It is the proceeds from this second-hand trade that I use in paying all my bills and taking care of my children.
Traders pay between $20 and $400 to get these bales of used clothing. They buy them from Ghanaian middlemen who receive the donations. And the traders often never know whether the content is trash or treasure. From a distance, I can see some traders saying a prayer before cutting their bales open. As I walk through the hot, congested market, I end up in a corner with tailors and seamstresses washing, ironing, and mending or altering. A few meters away, I meet 20-year-old Daniel Frimpong with tons of second-hand jeans and buckets of blue dye solution in front of him. He says the color washing enhances the look of the items, which attracts more buyers.
When we do it like this, they give us good price for the jeans trousers. The job is helping us, we the unemployed youth.
No matter one's profession, age and gender, almost everyone in Accra shops at Kantamantu. Today is Saturday, and so many of the country's youth, like Nanekia, have thronged the market to shop.
Well, I like buying my stuff at Kantamantu because you can basically get everything there. Like, you get everything.
But moving large bales around Kantamantu with its narrow alleys is a tedious task. Therefore, that job rests on the shoulders of hundreds of female head porters, locally known as Kayaye. These head porters often carry loads twice their body weight and make less than $5 a day. Safiatu Aliu is one of them.
Are you happy doing it? Does it profit you?
It is good. By the grace of God, it is going well.
Just nearby, I see heaps of partly burnt garbage dominated by stuff like jackets, underwear, brassiers and t-shirts. The reality is that every week, over 15 million pieces of used clothing arrive in Ghana from mostly the United States. And then 40% of those clothes leave the Kantamantu market as waste. Liz Ricketts is an American sustainable fashion campaigner in Ghana.
This isn't just an environmental crisis, it's a financial crisis for everyone who works in Kantamantu. Because the clothing is so much and so low quality, people just simply can't get their money back out and basically are operating in a debt cycle.
On top of that, every now and then, Accra experiences life-threatening floods that are worsened by the clothing waste that clog major open drains. Public health experts say this also increases the risks of malaria and cholera. Solomon Noy is head of waste management within the Accra metropolis. He says clothing in landfills creates huge amounts of methane gas and can cause devastating fires. Noy says this has led to the shutdown of the country's biggest landfill, which has compounded Ghana's waste management problems. On a visit to some beaches in Accra, I see textile waste and old clothing trapped in the sand ashore. Among the visible brands on the labels are H&M, Calvin Klein, Zara and Urban Outfitters.
So a huge chunk of textile waste is stockpiling at the ocean bed.
Noy says polluting the ocean hurts the over 2 million people in Ghana whose livelihoods depend on the fisheries sector.
Some time ago, we had deaths of some species of fish along the coastline. I can tell you, some percentage of our ocean aquatic life will go.
Every year, the fashion industry uses 93 billion cubic meters of water and is responsible for 10% of annual global carbon emissions, more than all international flights and maritime shipping combined, according to the United Nations Environment Programme. Liz Ricketts says industrialized countries need to take responsibility.
Countries in the global north need to pay ecological reparations to clean up the mess that has been made.
Solomon Noy has another solution.
If you ask me from where I sit, a ban on secondhand clothing is the way forward.
But for the thousands of traders at Kantamanto, any such move must come with an alternative source of livelihood, especially in a country where soaring unemployment could be debilitating. For The World, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Pornography is an industry with a history of inherent problems and easier to access than ever, courtesy of the internet. Starting this month, MasterCard says it will no longer process payments for adult websites. That is, unless they can confirm the ages and identities of people appearing in the videos. Performers who upload material will have to be verified users. It is not the first time a credit card company has taken a stand in the world of adult entertainment. Visa, Discover, and MasterCard have all ended their payment schemes on the adult video website Pornhub after allegations that they were contributing to sex trafficking. Reporter Tom Wainwright with our partners at The Economist says these are just some of the many examples of how credit card companies are now regulating online content. Here's Tom on The Economist podcast, The Intelligence.
Visa and MasterCard handle 90% of payments in the West. And so if they block out a website or a company or an industry, it's very, very difficult for that company to really continue on the same basis. And so the credit card firms in particular have an enormous clout in deciding what goes online. And if they decide that particular types of websites are not going to be allowed, as for example MasterCard is with these new rules for adult websites, it has a very big impact on those industries. Deciding where that line is and what's legal and illegal is not always straightforward. And there are many areas, including online pornography, where the law has arguably failed to keep pace with the speed of change in the industry. Online porn is pretty different now in the days of iPhones than it was 10 years ago when more of this stuff was professionally made. So in areas where the law hasn't really been updated, card companies and banks find themselves having to slightly fill in the blanks where legislators have not yet acted.
Tom Wainwright says financial companies want to ensure that only legal content is purchased, but it's more complicated than that.
It's difficult because I think they also face reputational concerns. You know, there's a lot of lobbying by campaigners who want to try and target financial companies as a way to reform these industries, because they found that targeting politicians sometimes doesn't get them very far because Congress is so often gridlocked. And they've also found that if they target financial companies, then their rules, of course, apply internationally. So campaigners of all sorts, and not just anti-porn campaigners, we've had anti-far-right campaigners as well, have targeted financial institutions, banks, credit card companies, trying to persuade them to drop particular clients, even if what those clients are doing isn't strictly illegal, because they found that it's a good way to try and stop this kind of content and these kinds of people from airing their views online.
How the companies feel about taking on this role, says Wainwright, is a mixed bag.
I think in some ways they probably feel pretty proud to be helping with law enforcement and helping crack down on some pretty bad stuff. But I think they also feel a certain amount of kind of discomfort that they've been handed this role as gatekeepers. And it reminds me of conversations that I've had with people who work in social media who don't feel all that wild about this role that they have in having to determine what kind of misinformation should be allowed and, you know, make these difficult calls on whether people should be allowed to say that face masks don't work or hydroxychloroquine is a great cure for COVID and that kind of thing. You know, they kind of feel uncomfortable making those decisions. And I think it's similar for card companies and payment networks, that they've been handed this role which sees some people accuse them of playing at being the kind of moral police, and other people accuse them of enabling wrongdoing and processing the payments of some pretty bad people. It's also expensive for them. Just as social networks employ thousands of people as moderators. Banks and card companies employ thousands of people fighting financial crime and looking at risk and compliance. So it's a kind of moral headache for them, but also a financial cost involved.
That was Tom Wainwright with our partner, The Economist, speaking about MasterCard's move to require adult websites to confirm the ages and identities of the people who appear in their videos. It's been just over 2 weeks now that the Pandora Papers were published, a bombshell report from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists detailing how the rich and powerful hide their money to avoid paying taxes. The leaked documents quickly led to a global series of official inquiries and dismissals. The revelations even flipped a government election in the Czech Republic. Now in Washington, a bipartisan group in Congress is introducing legislation they call the Enablers Act. Democratic Representative Tom Malinowski from New Jersey is helping to lead the charge. Congressman, what exactly is the Enablers Act?
For many years, when we've thought about money laundering, when we've thought about crooks and corrupt foreign officials trying to hide dirty money, we've imagined that the way to do that is, you know, you set up a Swiss bank account. But that's a very outdated concept because banks in the United States and in most countries now have to do a lot of due diligence when people show up with a suitcase full of cash. They have to file suspicious activity reports. They have to ask basic questions about who you are and where the money came from. So what kleptocrats tend to do now is to rely on other enablers to help them hide their ill-gotten gains. These can be lawyers who help them set up shell companies or trusts. There's a whole industry that has been set up, including in the United States, for this purpose. So what our bill, the Enablers Act, would do is to subject all of these other people and entities to the same simple requirements that banks have to meet, to file suspicious activity reports, ask basic questions.
And how wide-ranging is the definition of an enabler in the Enablers Act? Could it be a real estate agent who enables a property deal in California for a Mideast royal, for example?
Absolutely, yes, it could.
Don't you need the cooperation of other governments to amend their laws as well in order to prevent this?
Yes, but most Western countries are way ahead of the United States. And I would say, embarrassingly, America's where you go if you want to avoid paying taxes or to avoid having the people of your country know that you're stealing their money and hiding it away.
Is this issue bridging the aisle in a bipartisan way?
Our bill is 100% bipartisan. That's one thing that gives me hope that we may be able to actually get this legislation moving.
And why do you think, Congressman, this issue in particular is doing that?
Fortunately, there is still a bipartisan consensus that corruption is wrong.
Have you actually learned of any lobbying efforts against you in this bill?
Well, we just introduced it, so give them time. But I think as this moves forward, I would imagine an army of well-paid lobbyists and lawyers descending on Capitol Hill trying to convince us not to do this obvious thing.
Congressman Malinowski, it's been just over 2 weeks since the Pandora Papers dropped. What have you heard from the Biden White House yet in terms of concrete support for your bill?
The Biden administration has been talking about cracking down on these kinds of enablers since even before President Biden's inauguration.
Have they at least spoken to you about what you're undertaking with this bill?
Yes, so we've been in very close communication with them over the last several months.
Any promises from the White House yet?
No, but I would be certainly not be surprised if we get strong support from the administration for this approach.
Finally, Congressman, why do you care about this problem of offshore tax evasion? Why are you leading the charge on this bill?
Before I was elected to Congress, I served in the State Department, helped to lead our anti-corruption efforts around the world. And in talking to dissidents, to campaigners for democracy and the rule of law in countries like China, countries like Russia, the number one request they had for me was to close America's doors to dirty money being stolen by their leaders.
All right. So it sounds like you're working not just on behalf of U.S. taxpayers, but people around the globe who are also impacted by offshore tax havens.
I think corruption is what sustains dictatorship. So when America stands up against kleptocracy and corruption, we are in total solidarity with people all around the world.
Democratic Representative Tom Malinowski from New Jersey, a member of a bipartisan group of lawmakers working on the Enablers Act, designed to regulate the accountants, lawyers, financial advisors, and others whose roles in stashing cash offshore have been revealed in the Pandora Papers. Congressman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Relations between Moscow and the West continue to reach new post-Cold War lows. Today, Russia said it is closing its diplomatic mission in Brussels to the Western military alliance, NATO. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said it was retaliation for NATO's recent move, suspending 8 Russians accused of spying. Moscow has dismissed those accusations as baseless. NATO and Russia have maintained open channels of communication for high-level military coordination. Today, Minister Lavrov slammed the door on that. He said there is no need to, quote, keep pretending that an equitable dialogue was possible in the foreseeable future. Hundreds of naked people painted white like pillars of salt. If you'd been in Israel along the banks of the Dead Sea yesterday, you could have seen them standing like statues. It was part of a project by American artist and photographer Spencer Tunick. Tunick was brought to Israel to help raise awareness about the uncertain future of the Dead Sea. Ari Leon Fruchter is a founder of the Dead Sea Museum and a close collaborator with Tunick on this project. Ari, placed this at the photo shoot yesterday. Describe what you saw and what the whole scene was like.
The photo shoot took place in Arad, so it's actually way, way above the Dead Sea, overlooking the Moab Desert. Incredible, like, you know, scenery. But in the background, you actually see the Dead Sea itself. But it was a very, very, very spiritual and I'd say just breathtaking installation. People were so excited to be there. They traveled far. They waited a long time. And everyone that was there really cares about the Dead Sea.
As to what it was like walking on this area, we actually spoke to one of the models, a man named Elias Dandecker, and he said the terrain was pretty challenging.
Yet all of us pulled together to do it, and there's nothing like a cool breeze on a naked body, I can say.
Although he also complained about sharp stones under his feet. Describe some of these photos for us, Ari. Why was it hard for the models to get that footing? What were they actually doing?
The surface was very, very like rocky and difficult to walk on. So we had special shoes that each participant was able to use. They had to actually traverse, from one area to another area. So they had to walk slowly. And for some of them, it was a breeze. For others, it took some time, but people helped out. There were some elderly people, with ailments. So it'd be very, very, careful in terms of helping them across it. But if they were true champions, Spencer calls them art warriors. They, all went for it.
And help us understand kind of the concept then between Tunick and what he's saying. What is he saying about the Dead Sea and how does this project kind of communicate that idea?
Spencer has been to Israel, to the Dead Sea, 3 times. The first time in 2011 was really to kind of make the world aware of this magical place. Sadly, less than 5 years later, the actual location, Mineral Beach, where he shot, completely collapsed into a giant sinkhole, making it inaccessible. So in 2016, he came back and did a secret installation, kind of explaining to the world what the sinkhole phenomenon is and why it's so dangerous. As the water recedes, what happens is the ground becomes unstable and these cavities open up. And once it happens, it can't be repaired. Mm. The Jordanians face the same problem as well. There's a lot of agriculture there. You'll see in the field sometimes just giant sinkholes, buildings collapsing into it. It's quite scary.
So these art projects that you've undertaken with Tunick inspired you to create the Dead Sea Museum. What are your hopes for that?
We actually have a virtual museum and people can go there, anytime for free and go inside it and experience their art exhibitions. The physical Dead Sea Museum is meant to be something of a kind of like a beacon of hope where people could kind of gather and have an experience they can no longer have at the Dead Sea itself because of its issues.
I've seen over time any number of projects where the concept is large numbers of naked people in a certain space. My understanding, though, is that Spencer Tunick has been really successful at making these photo shoots happen and convincing people to get naked for his concept. Why do you think he has been successful?
Spencer started over 30 years ago. He was arrested constantly, and he fought for his art as freedom of speech and the First Amendment. Actually went to the Supreme Court, and he won. And from that, he's taken it across the United States and then all around the world.
Ari Leon Fruchter is the founder of the Dead Sea Museum and a close collaborator of Spencer Tunick, who has been taking photos of hundreds of nude subjects at the Dead Sea this week. Ari's been speaking with us from the Dead Sea. Thank you very much. Good to meet you.
Likewise, Marco. Thank you.
TikTok was launched 5 years ago, and what an exciting little life it's had so far. Trump banned it, Biden reversed that, and during the pandemic, the short-form videos really took off in popularity. They've come a long way from their goofy origins, you know, Gen Z users dancing and lip-syncing. One of the innovative ways people are now using the app is to teach indigenous languages across the globe. The world's Bianca Hillier has our story.
If you know anything about TikTok, you know the algorithm can get to know you really well, really fast. All it took was watching a couple of videos from indigenous creators.
I'm going to say some keywords. First one is wash your hands. Kasichichi. Repeat after me. Kasichichi.
My For You page was quickly filled with native languages, including from the folks at the Manitoba Indigenous Cultural Education Center.
Bonjour! Noa Indigenous Cause. Bawatagon, Ndonji, and Ndanokioma, MICEC.
Noah Malastravich works at the center. He and his colleagues have been teaching Cree and Ojibwe on TikTok since the pandemic began and the center was closed. Their content is relatable and practical. For example, they have a whole series on common small talk.
We're always trying to answer the question, Anin Ejuebak, how's the weather?
As the seasons have changed, they teach people how to answer that question.
Let's go over the word for it's cold out, which is takaya.
And the answer today is gijide. Gijide, it's hot out.
For the weather today, mispun, mispun, it's snowing, mispun anot.
Malastravich says they plan to continue posting even after the pandemic is over because of how accessible the content is and how it's uniquely suited for learning a language.
You could rewatch these videos, so it's not like when we used to go to the classes and you'd try to memorize what someone said. So I think if people continue to put material out on TikTok, it's like a library.
A similar library of content is being built around indigenous languages in Mexico.
Time to handle the future tense and know it. So essentially, you'll have your verb right here, and then you add C to it, to the end.
More than a million people across the country speak Nahuatl today, but on TikTok, millions more are learning the language. Vocab lessons are everywhere.
What is a day? Yauquisque. Yauquisque. And that means army.
But fluent speakers aren't the only ones finding an audience. From down in New Zealand, Josh Kirkley is sharing his own journey of learning the Maori language.
Maori words that I've said wrong and they've embarrassed me. Keke, cake, keke, armpit.
Cake and armpit. Close, but not the same. Kirkley is Maori on his dad's side, and he wasn't raised with the culture, so he spent the last 3 years learning the language.
A lot of my videos are not actually me teaching. It's more just what I went through or something that happened. And that's something that you can't Google, you know, what does it feel like to learn Te Reo Māori? There's so many of us, I think, on a really similar journey.
James Wright is another Maori teacher on TikTok. For him, sharing the language is about more than teaching people new words. He hopes it's an entry point for decolonization.
When you learn Te Reo Māori, you learn about the history of it. You learn about the laws that were put in place to prevent it from being spoken, the abuse that people suffered in schools because they spoke it.
Wright believes these short videos can be a real tool in revitalizing native languages and normalizing them for those outside of Indigenous communities. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.